This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
When you stop and think about it, a bachelor's degree in, well, just about anything is pretty much a one-size-fits-all exercise. Students take the same classes from the same instructors and take the same exams, but that could be changing.
So we have 20 different concentrations that lead to 154 different possible combinations for that degree, the BS in Business.
So after talking about degrees in Homeland Security and gaming in the past 2 weeks, today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a new customizable business degree program. We'll also talk about big data. Hint, it's everywhere. And we'll spend an academic minute with the story of the only female governor in the U.S. to die in office. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. It's safe to say that not all businesses in the U.S., or in the world for that matter, can be run the same way. So it makes sense that students looking for a business degree would want to make sure they have the unique tools they need for their career path. That's the rationale behind the new business major program at Siena College in Loudonville, New York. Rather than pigeonhole all students into a generic degree, the school has created a program that would allow students to choose from 20 distinct concentrations that can be combined to create 184 unique educational tracks. Here to talk about this new idea is Dr. Charles Seifert, Dean of Siena's School of Business. I asked him what the department saw that led to the creation of this program.
All right, so it really was a project that was developed really from the ground up. So what we started doing is I became dean about 2 years ago, and I said, we're going to look at everything that we're doing. We're not going to change everything, but we're going to look at it. And we wanted to make sure that we were providing a program that provided the best quality, the best relevance, and the applicability for the students. So we started and we were looking at our business core, which is the courses that we offer to all of our different students. And we said, well, that's in pretty good shape, but what is it that we're doing that's adding value for the students? And so we started looking at our majors, and we have majors in accounting, economics, finance, management, and marketing. And those are absolutely great programs, but everybody has those same programs. So what can we do to really add value? So we started looking at what are the core topics that really need to be delivered within those different areas. Like, as an example, finance. You have corporate finance and you have investments. But to get a degree in finance, you have to take corporate and investments. So why don't we look at the core information that's required for corporate finance and separate that out and call that a concentration, and look at what's required for investments and separate that out, and then allow the students to add another concentration to further augment their educational experience and their preparation for a career. So if you want corporate finance, it would be a good combination to have accounting and finance, have those two concentrations, and they build together for the one degree, the BS in Business. Let me take just a step back and tell you really what the program's about. I think a good understanding of the program will make more sense. What we have is we have that business core that I talked about, that the same courses that all the students have to take, and it's across all the different disciplines. And then students have to take 30 credits in a particular discipline in order to get a major. So what we did is we took and looked at different concentrations, and two 15-credit concentrations can be combined in order to equal the BS in Business. So we have 20 different concentrations that lead to 154 different possible combinations for that degree, the BS in Business. So if you're interested in management, that's a pretty general topic, right? You have a degree in management. Now you could get a BS in Business with a concentration in international business and ethical leadership in a global environment.
You're still walking out of there with a business degree.
A BS in Business, absolutely. A Bachelor's of Science in Business. But what we're doing is we're saying, you know, what is it that's interesting to you? What is it that you're looking to do in the future? And let's focus your educational experience so that you can get the best possible combination to prepare you for the future. and again, our 20 different concentrations ranging all the way from entrepreneurship to business analytics, sports and service marketing, and they can be within the same discipline or they can be within different disciplines in order for them to obtain the knowledge that they need in order to be successful, not just for their first job, but for their career.
Do you see this change being driven by the needs of students or the needs of business?
Both. When we were developing this program, we met with a variety of different business leaders in industry, including human resource directors, bankers, insurance people, all sorts of different people, and we started proposing these different ideas. And they said, you know, look, number one, we're a liberal arts institution, so you get that foundation, that critical thinking, looking at problems from different perspectives, and then that experience or that educational experience in those different areas, which is better preparing the students. So the business leaders thought that it was a wonderful idea. All of the students that I've spoken to are really excited about it because it's not pigeonholing them into one of five different majors. It's really giving them the opportunity to explore a variety of them. And also the way we designed the program, you don't have to come in and say, hey, I want to do business analytics. You're actually taking courses within those different concentrations, and then usually by their junior year, they decide what those concentrations are going to be in order to develop that BS in business.
This is not the first time this month I've heard people talk about concentrations in within majors. Is this something that's going on across the country now?
Looking at concentrations within majors is a little bit different approach in that you still would get the one major and then one concentration within that field, but this is really allowing you to look at or sample across two different disciplines to really diversify that knowledge base. But absolutely, schools are starting to look at what we need to do to provide the best product for our customer, which is the student. And another really interesting thing that we can do is in order to get a new program approved, we had to go through, you know, the internal college. We had to go to State Ed, which, by the way, did a great job. But we have to go through all those different steps. Now what we can do is we can add new concentrations and look at what the future is going to be and be able to be much more responsive to what's happening as compared to reacting to what other people are doing. So we can do a modification, add a different concentration, and then we can monitor it and modify it moving forward and really make sure that we're providing what the students need, not just today, but 5 years from now.
Has this program started, and if so, how many you got in there?
Yeah, we submitted it to State Ed for approval, received approval actually faster than we thought we were going to, and we're offering it right now. And we've already have, you know, literally for the freshmen coming in, we probably have like 12 to 15 students that are already interested in the program, but we really haven't even marketed it yet. So we're anticipating that it's going to be very positive. It is brand new.
Is this something that would work with other degree programs?
Absolutely. And they are looking at similar models. We have a school of liberal arts and a school of science, and they're looking at trying to adapt it as well. And in addition, if you have a major in the humanities or in the sciences, you can also take a concentration within the school of business. Granted, I'm biased, but irrespective of where you're working, you're going to need to know some of those business fundamentals. You're going to be managing people, you're going to be influencing people, and you're going to be running budgets or monitoring budgets and doing strategic implementation. So it's a really good idea to have that opportunity to gain one of those concentrations.
I imagine with liberal arts, you could go anywhere with that.
Absolutely. A psychology degree with a human resource, strategic human resource concentration is an absolutely wonderful combination. It really was designed in order to enhance the overall availability of programs to the students so that they can design something that best meets their needs. Frequently, when I was doing open houses, people would come up and say, can I major in sports marketing? And I'd say, well, no, you can major in marketing and then get an internship and work experience in sports marketing. And now I can say, yes, you can, and you can further augment that with something else. So it really gives the students the opportunity to create and develop degrees that best meet their needs for the future. and it also provides them greater opportunity to go down different paths.
Is this something that might change degree programs beyond bachelor's degrees?
Absolutely. It could very easily progress into a master's degree as well, so that students could have a concentration in the undergraduate and then have concentrations at the master's degree as well and have a very nice flow from one to the other. They could also have different concentrations at the undergraduate versus the graduate degree.
A lot more choices available than when I went to school.
Oh, I know. I mean, I had five, right? And I had to pick one of the five. And the same thing. And, you know, the students also get to take classes before they decide what those concentrations are going to be. And they can modify their choices even after they've made them, you know, within some limitation. It is really a simple model that is very, very complex to put together, right? So if you think about five different departments at Siena College coming together and creating 20 different concentrations in order to allow students to really explore the interests that are right for them, as well as also gaining the expertise necessary to be prepared not just for that first job, but for their career.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's get together next summer and talk about how the first year went.
And I'd love to. I really would. We're really excited about it. We've received some very, very positive feedback, and I'm convinced that it's going to be a movement towards the future.
I asked, you know, about if this was going on in other places. Have you reached out to other schools or institutions that are doing this to say, you know, how'd you set yours up?
I will tell you that I've done some rather extensive research, and I'm not aware of any program anywhere that offers the amount of flexibility and degree options that we're offering. So there are other schools that do offer concentrations, and there's one school in particular that requires you to have a concentration, but there's none that I'm aware of that combine the two concentrations to meet the degree requirements.
I imagine you'll have a few eyes looking over your shoulder then.
we're trying to position ourselves and take advantage of that first mover advantage.
Dr. Charles Seifert is the Dean of the School of Business at Siena College in Loudonville, New York. Still to come, big data is everywhere, including here, next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Big data now seems to be everywhere. Google searches are being used to predict flu outbreaks, and airline statistics are mined to determine the best hour of which day to book plane tickets. Science can also benefit from these trends. Given the emerging importance of reproducible data analysis pipelines, one could think of a special group of trained big data experts that could be available to regulatory agencies and to clinical laboratories for review and auditing of their processes and practices, and who might be able to offer suggestions for improvements. That's the topic of an article from the journal Clinical Chemistry titled "Learning from Our Mistakes: The Future of Validating Complex Diagnostics." The lead author of that opinion piece was Dr. Stephen Master, Chief of Clinical Chemistry and Director of the Central Laboratory at the Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York City, where he also serves as a member of their Institute for Precision Medicine. Last summer, I asked Dr. Master to first simply tell us, what is big data?
Well, big data is a term that really reflects a fairly recent and rapid increase in the pure amount of information that's being collected. And specifically, it's being collected in a way that can be easily analyzed using computational tools. So maybe the most well-known example of big data comes from companies like Google or Amazon or Netflix, who can use the data that they gather to predict what you want to see or buy. So in the case of Amazon, for example, when you see the books that are recommended for you, that list has been produced by an algorithm based on what Amazon knows about you and your shopping habits, as well as on the aggregated shopping habits of a much larger customer base. Or in the case of Google, the information that's available from your search history or your Gmail or whatever else Google knows about you can be computationally analyzed using machine learning approaches and used to predict what ads you should be shown. So at the commercial level, big data approaches have been extremely powerful. So if big data can be used to predict something like consumer behavior, then it's certainly exciting to try and apply the same techniques to predict the outcome of disease and to provide better patient care. I think it's probably worth highlighting at least two ways in which this is happening. The first is that as electronic medical records improve, a number of groups are trying to use big data strategies to learn about statistical relationships that will help to guide medical management of patients. And of course, the data that are generated from the clinical lab are in many ways perfect for this application, since they already exist often in a numeric form that can be easily adapted for the kinds of data mining purposes we care about. So that's one fairly obvious and potentially powerful way to apply big data in medical care. The second way is also interesting, though, because it shows that the big data that are useful to predict disease can sometimes come from unexpected places. So in 2009, a group from Google published a paper in Nature in which they showed that they could predict influenza outbreaks in the U.S. by tracking search terms that Google gathered. At first glance, this doesn't seem like medical data, but it turned out that this project, which was called Google Flu Trends, was able to provide accurate results 1 to 2 weeks earlier than the CDC. So it held out the prospect of significant public health benefit.
What do you think that initiatives like the Google Flu Trends project can teach us about testing in the clinical lab?
Well, on the one hand, as I've indicated, Google Flu Trends was a great example of using big data in healthcare. Google's process, which included mining 50 million search terms in an unguided way and coming up with a predictive diagnostic, is a great example of how machine learning can work. And those of us in the clinical lab, who also increasingly manage large data sets, coming from both the fact that we see large numbers of patients and also from the fact that we measure more and more things about those patients. And you can just think, for example, of the marked increase in data that have come from the widespread adoption of genomic testing, for example. So when you think about the analogy between, say, Google and the clinical lab, you can see why there's a lot of excitement about using similar algorithms to analyze lab data. Now, I should say, though, that there's a catch. The flip side of the story is that although Google Flu Trends did a great job in the 2007-2008 flu season, by 2012 it was not performing as well. It turns out that changes in the usage of terms by Google's users, among other things, were leading to poorer performance. So when Google went back and incorporated data from 2010 and 2011 into their model, their 2012 predictions improved. Okay, so what does this tell us about the clinical lab? Well, we face an analogous situation, as you know. For example, when treatments change or patient populations change, it may be that we'll see changes in the performance of complex algorithms that we may develop for diagnostics. So in this article, we argue that it is very important not to lock ourselves into static models, but rather to build in statistical approaches that can be dynamically refined over time. And this is what we mean by learning from our mistakes.
The March 2014 issue of Science had an article that stated that Google was guilty of big data hubris. What do you think of that?
Well, as I said, there are a number of things that have been noted about Google Flu Trends subsequent to its original publication in 2009. Some of that had to do with the problems that arose from not incorporating the 2010-2011 search term changes. And so certainly one could take this too far and say that Google has decided that they can predict the entire world simply based on search terms. But nonetheless, it is the case that Google Flu Trends does a remarkable job at predicting the flu, given the caveats about retraining the algorithm. And that's really one of the things that was an impetus for us writing this article, was to say that in the same way, we don't want to be caught in the clinical laboratory community with static algorithms that do not reflect changes that occur in our underlying patient populations or in their underlying treatment.
What are some of the risks involved in using complex algorithms to interpret laboratory data?
Well, the main difficulty with using complex algorithms is that they can hide many other mistakes in medical research, whether those are errors in study design or problems with pre-analytical variation or issues with the data management itself. There have been a number of examples over the last decade or so where complex biological data have been interpreted using an algorithm in a way that is just frankly incorrect, we now know. And there's at least one publicized case in which this led to patients being placed into inappropriate arms of a clinical oncology trial. So clearly this is something that needs to be very carefully considered. So how can we address this? One solution has been to try and understand the underlying biology that drives the algorithm. Another strategy has been to make sure that there's appropriate regulatory oversight, and this is certainly something that the FDA, for example, has been very aware of. Now, a third response came from what was really a landmark report released in 2012 by the Institute of Medicine that recommended that these kinds of complex algorithms, specifically when applied to omics assays such as genomics, proteomics, or metabolomics, should be completely specified in a final form prior to rigorous clinical testing in order to ensure that their behavior is well understood.
Now, finally, Doctor, you mentioned earlier that Google Flu Trends demonstrated the value of moving beyond static models. Would this approach have any implications for the way that diagnostic tests are regulated?
Yes, I'm very glad you brought that up. In this paper, we argued that one lesson of Google Flu Trends is that you can't just mine big data, create a great algorithm, and then stop. But as treatment paradigms or patient populations change, it will be necessary to update our models based on new data that comes in. Now, the way that we as a field currently handle this from a regulatory perspective is to say, you've created an assay with a static diagnostic algorithm. We've tested that static algorithm. And if things stop working down the road, then we'll start the process all over again. What we're proposing is an alternative where we say that it's possible to learn from our mistakes using a more dynamic approach while still being rigorous using tools such as Bayesian statistics to continually update our algorithms based on new data that we receive.
Dr. Stephen Master is Chief of Clinical Chemistry and the Director of the Clinical Laboratory at the Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York City. When then-Alabama Governor George Wallace left office in 1966 because of term limits, he chose who he thought was the perfect successor, his wife. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Studying women in politics helps us understand the past and how to improve the future. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Laura Albright, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Indianapolis, examines the life of a former female governor and shows us how far we still have to go.
As part of my research looking at women in American politics, I've recently examined the political life of Lurline Wallace, who was elected governor of Alabama in 1966 after her husband, former governor George Wallace, could not run for re-election because of term limits. George persuaded Lurline to run, and she became Alabama's first woman governor, even though she was battling cancer. Education and healthcare were strong interests of Lurline Wallace, and she campaigned on them. While she also emphasized segregation in schools, to her credit, she was very influential in mental health issues. She was the first governor to tour the mental hospital in Tuscaloosa, where she saw decrepit conditions. Saying she refused to have other people's children treated in this way, she led a reevaluation of mental health in Alabama and brought more awareness and resources to the issue. No other governor in the state had done that. She lost her battle with cancer in 1968 after serving in office just 478 days and remains the only female governor of the United States to have died in office. While her medical records revealed that it was clear she was not going to survive her illness, every press release and speech George Wallace made at the time emphasized that she was improving and almost back to full health. Lurline Wallace was not told about the cancer when the doctors learned of it because, as was the customary practice at the time, the doctors informed a woman's husband of her health and let him choose whether to tell her about it. She found out about the cancer only when a mutual friend accidentally revealed that this diagnosis was not her first, but rather a likely recurrence. George had informed his staff, but not his own wife, the most politically powerful woman in the state. Studying women in politics offers insights on some of our nation's growth and remaining challenges. By recognizing our history, both the good and the bad, we can appreciate how far we have come and can be inspired to improve and progress even further.
That was Laura Albright of the University of Indianapolis. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other national productions and WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.